Adam.
Hey, D.
What's up? What are we talking about today? I was like, what's the question? Before, this is part two.
Before you say, hey, Adam, you need to have a question.
Probably have a question. Yeah, let's do it again. Okay. Hey, Adam.
Okay. Hey, D.
What did I talk about at my SEDMA keynote?
I don't know, but did it involve the transition from customer education to scaled CX?
I think it did.
I don't know why I said I don't know, because I was there. This is CXetera, where we discuss the future of CX.
And a little bit more.
Amazing. Okay, I think we're getting this down.
Music.
Yeah, you don't need to do that, because the music is playing under us right now. So you don't also need to do it.
You're that. You edit these, which I'm so grateful for. So I can just show up and be silly and it up. That's my role.
Yeah, I'm only bringing it up because probably that means that you're like uns is like conflicting with Alan Coda's
sorry, Alan.
Ponzu Squib track. He lives in your neighborhood. He's going
to
be mad.
I know,
he's going
to
see you.
He's going to see me, his dog.
He's going to see
like,
you.
Get that woman. Don't let her in our path.
She owns on my path.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your day two SEDMA conference keynote. And I'm going to say to all of our listeners that if you want all of the preamble about SEDMA and what it is and what we thought of the conference and how much fun we had in Austin, please go listen to the previous episode that will have aired by this point, where we talked about my keynote, which was the day one keynote. And now, as linear time progresses, we are going to the day two keynote, which was D.
Yeah, so Adam did the keynote on day one when everyone's like bright and shiny, and then I did the keynote. Like, who are you going to bring in to do the keynote when they're a little bit hungover? Me.
People needed it. People needed it. Like, I had the easier job. I always love your energy. I mean, there's a reason why we have a podcast together.
Yes.
But I think, like, you also did. You did a great job bringing both, like, energy as well as a lot of practicality and focus to day two.
Thank you. That's great. That's, you know, wasn't necessarily my intention, but I always hope for that as an outcome.
Well, that's how you show up in the world. So
that's how I try to show up in the world. So that's awesome. Yeah. And I got to, it was really fun. I'm excited to kind of dig into the talk. You know, for folks listening, we'll post the slides. Although there's not too many, I tried to stick to, now I have 9 slides, including the cover.
You and I have opposite approaches to slide development. I'm like a slide maximalist, and you were somehow able to condense everything into actually like very minimal slide wear. Like, how did you approach that?
So I'm a former slide maximalist. Like, I've never met a slide deck that I wanted to end. Like, there was a time where I used to, this is very cringe/embarrassing, like whatever the kids are saying these days. Like, I used to say, like, I think in slides. And that comes from being in professional services. I mean, like, pretty much your bread and butter is a slide deck. And, you know, I grew up in professional services at Box, which is like the best game and, you know, the best in the game, really, when it comes to ProServe and the presentations and the polish and all of that at Box, like, is just unparalleled. And so really into decks. And then I get to Miro. And obviously I use our product for presentations and, you know, they're really interactive and that kind of a thing. But Matt Mulholland on my team, he does that kind of Steve Jobs slide thing where he'll have like a word on a slide or an image on a slide, and he builds the presentation around it. And it's like incredible. And then he'll move to the next slide and he'll have your, you know, required stats or whatever. So concise, like it takes a lot of structured thinking, which I love logic and structured thinking. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things, like, Matt and I always, like, that's how we interview for folks on our team as well, right? We really look for people who can think well and who can articulate their thinking well. And so I just saw his deck and I was just like, this is such a great way to do this, right? To like start with one small kernel of an idea and then like really build it out to like what's appropriate. So when the occasion allows, try to do that walking deck style thing. Laura on my team, another leader on my team, is really great at this too. she's got one always for her program. And like, that's something that I just love. I love seeing these types of concise decks. And so anyway, so I try, yeah. I don't always do it, but in this case, I was able to like condense it down. And I think also the format of Miro has given me the flexibility to do that with, you know, the fact that I can really generate content very quickly. Shameless plug.
Yeah. And it was cool to see you, you know, have things on sticky notes and, It to me, it felt like, because I'm also a big fan of the walking deck, it felt like a combination of a walking deck and a mind map. And it also, you know, was able to showcase Miro as this combination of, I think, like structured thinking, but also ideation and brainstorming. And like, here are the concepts that I'm going to draw together. And so that's where I actually think you hit that mark in terms of, let's say, like energy and focus, because it felt like you were bringing us into your own mind and showing us those associations and that we were kind of going through those lives. So I think that's what kind of kept people engaged in following it, because it's not just like, oh, here, I'm like reading off the bullet points.
Yeah. And I'm trying, you know, I think this is something that was like an unlock for me. Like my coach really helped with Brad, who you know too. We try not to bring you up, Brad, all the time in our episodes, but it's like,
I would like it on record. I did not do it this time.
You didn't do it this time. I know. He'll love this. I'll have to tell him to listen to this. But it's like, I was talking to him once, like 5 years ago, where I was like, man, I have a sequence of talks I have to give. And I'm just like getting a bit burnt out on building the collateral around it. And he was like, what's your problem, dude? Like, just kind of do it. Just talk. It's something you know very, very well. So you shouldn't have to over prepare for it. And focus on the simplicity of the slides and just talk about the things that you're going to talk about. And I think that helped as well.
So Dee, like maybe you can take me through a little bit of just generally what was your presentation about. And then I would love to zoom in on some specific moments with you.
Yeah, man. So it was about transitioning from customer education to skilled customer experience and really like my journey from a career perspective, right? Like moving through working in different parts of the function of CX, right? So support, pro serve, customer education, customer success. And really like, I feel like the role that I have now and kind of the like these roles are becoming more and more popular, right? It's like having all of these things being incredibly high functioning, scalable, you know, operationally mature programs that serve customers in various ways across their journey, right? And so I just talked about how I got to where I'm at, the opportunities I was given and what I did with them, and then really like how you can build a program like this from scratch as well, where you're actually focused on a customer journey or blurring the lines between pre-sales and post-sales. You're, you know, bringing together the best of like self-serve, one-to-many, you know, education, automation, AI, you know, you name it, to like actually serve up offerings to customers to help them get to their outcomes with your product, right? Whatever those outcomes may be, and doing it in a horizontal, vertical way, and being able to scale all of that. So it was really about what that looks like, obviously, with sort of our origins of customer education being a big underpinning of it, right? Content is a big underpinning of it. And and how do you build all that and then take it to this next place?
Yeah. And I mean, again, I think it was super that you got really practical around how you weave these programs together into something bigger. So, Dee, one thing that really resonated with me from your talk was the idea that, you know, within Scaled CX, within your program, you own a segment. And that gives you, in some ways, latitude and ownership over what experiences that you offer, even though the things that you create can be used for larger customers. You have this whole segment of customers that you own. So can you take me deeper into that? Like, what does that mean for you to own the segment?
Sure. Yeah, great question. So the first thing I will say is that shout out to my former CRO, Sang, who you also know, Sangeeta Chakraborty. She's awesome. And really, like, we went on this journey together. And like, I owe a lot of our success to her and her mentorship. So when we first started talking about this idea, it was really about the strategy of digital success. And then eventually it became this thing about, all right, let's look at your, you know, your entire book of business and figure out how we're going to splice it, how we're going to cover it, and how this is going to sustain us. Because when you're a hyper growth company, or really just any company, and you get past a certain amount of maturity in ARR, you have to figure out how to get out of the linear headcount growth game, right? Yep, and you totally. Also have to think about the fact that your customers want optionality. You know, they're not like, not everybody wants to jump on a phone to like get help with something super simple. It's very annoying. We wouldn't do it. You and I would be like trying absolutely everything before we called somebody to get right. And so
we make this assumption, right, that like everyone wants these white glove experiences. Everyone wants to be able to pick up the phone and call. Well, you do if you need to, but you don't by default.
Right. And I think that gone are the days where like custom, bespoke, and all of that stuff like actually matters to people. Like it sounds good, but when you get down to what's underneath it, that's when people really have opinions, right? Like you're just because you position something as something doesn't mean you're like the outcome for the customer is going to be what you promised, or that your CSAT score is going to be based on your positioning of it being customer bespoke, right? Like your skilled stuff is going to get a brutal CSAT as much as your like bespoke and custom pro serve stuff is, right? So it's like, I think like that's like important to understand. Ultimately, like the experience is experience, and achieving an outcome is what's important for a customer, right? And we've got to give them many ways to get there and save time and all of those things. And so, so we were talking about all of that, and it became pretty obvious to us that like we wanted to move the future of Miro's CS model. And keep in mind, this was many years ago. So we really just had high touch success, right? Period. End of sentence. And so what we needed to do was create a digital success program, but we also needed to create a scaled success program. And when we did the math and we like worked with our ops and data teams to sort of like look at the numbers, and we did benchmarking, we talked to a lot of people, you know, one of the things that I had heard was, you know, you want to aim for those first couple of years to have about 20% of your business be only digital, meaning that you're not actually staffing CSMs to that book of business. You know, this is a guideline. It's not a rule, because again, it depends on what type of business it is, right? If you're working, again, in something highly technical that requires a lot of support in implementing, then this is probably not going to be the right solution. Like I'm being overly simplistic, but that's one way to think about it.
And it's probably going to look different based on like the distribution of your ARR, right?
That's right. Exactly. And I think like, you know, so once you do all of your slicing and you kind of like get into thinking it through, you can actually, there's businesses that have a digital motion that is 40%. Like that's like the industry benchmark of like, wow, that's incredible. But that's like a level of maturity in ARR. That's, you know, it's years away. You know, that's not where you're going to start. So I think like 20% was our goal. We exceeded that, you know, pretty quickly. But you know, the plan was always have a segment, right? Because again, the problem we were trying to solve was this linear headcount model. Also the fact that we had a ton of really small customers coming in, right? Post-pandemic. So that was about the segment, but it was always also as a strategy. So digital as a segment and a strategy, meaning you're going to have digital be the base of everything as you move, you know, up market as well. And so, you know, to me, we powered in that first 2 years of this, we powered actually like over 70% of accounts with this motion. Like we hadn't moved up to our like, you know, the highest touch segment yet at the time, but we very rapidly were able to serve customers in the digital and scaled book of business. And so to me, when I think about, all right, defining scaled CX, obviously it can look very different. These things are going to be, you know, this is a common theme in your keynote as well. Like it's not about cookie cutter. It's not about copy pasting. Look at your contacts, you know, talk to your internal partners, customers, et cetera, and come up with what makes sense for you. But I am very partial to saying that a scaled CX program absolutely should also have a defined segment that is owned by a digital success team that is responsible for its, you know, activation, for its, you know, active usage, its adoption, as well as its like pre-renewals and kind of getting into that year two and beyond.
Yeah, because if you're, I mean, especially in a PLG business,
mm-hmm.
where like if you have ownership of the segment, if you have ownership of the outcomes, then when push comes to shove, you can make the decisions about what experiences we deliver to customers, what programs we use to do it, while still preserving. And maybe here we kind of get into, you started with some design principles, which I really liked. Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned this a moment ago, optionality for your customers mm-hmm. and making sure that they still have multiple paths based on their preferences to be able to achieve their outcomes. But you can still look at any of the programs that you're offering, whether they're educational, whether they're campaign-based, et cetera, to see which ones work for which types of customers.
Yep. The only thing I might like sort of tweak in what you just said is like a PLG business, I think it takes a lot to convince die-hard, like sacred, you know, PLG is everything folks that like digital success and scaled CX have a place in their organization. They need to be at some level of like sales-led and go-to-market maturity to be open to even having that conversation. Because when they're not, what you're going to hear when you have the conversation initially is, oh, you want to send emails, you want to do stuff in app. That's PLG. Get out of my face. And I have come up against that in multiple roles with multiple people. And I think it requires a level of like go-to-market maturity to understand how those things are different. They certainly have an overlap, but what doesn't, right? Like if you have a healthy organization, there's going to be overlap in functions and programs across the board. And you're going to have conversations about who owns what or how do we like partner best together. But for some reason, digital success, because it's newer, it's a tougher conversation in the PLG space for sure.
I'm glad that you stopped me and called me on that, because even as I was saying that a moment ago, like there was something kind of ringing in my head, which you just articulated really well. What I was thinking when I originally said that is like, it's more important in a PLG business because you have this larger base of essentially self-serve customers who have already opted 100%. Their way into a non-human touch experience. But to your point, like it's more challenging to take ownership of it when it's you not sitting in product trying to negotiate and broker this with your product team, who feels like probably they should like own the entire customer experience PLG, right? Like trial to renewal.
Right. And I mean, I think, you know, there's like, even in the sales led world, like this all also happens between like sales and marketing, right? Like who's responsible for what, and like in terms of leads and conversion, like they're having that same conversation on the sales led side too, which is funny, right? Like,
it's who do you want to be fighting with, right? Like, do you want to be having this argument with product, or do you want to be having this argument with sales?
Exactly. Right. And so, so I think taking the best of both worlds, and then I guess I'm saying arguing with everybody is like the best way to go. Yeah. Right. Cause then you can be more customer centric because you understand the holistic experience, but you make sure that in terms of staffing across your company and across your teams, that you're putting people, it's a skills-based organization, and you're putting people that have deep experience in these things against those problems, right? So for digital success, I think it's like really important. Yes, you need those partners on like your growth teams, your PLG teams, like all of that. You really need to have people that have worked, honestly, I think in high touch, in operations, and some of these other strong go-to-market, like customer-centric fields or roles to be able to be successful. Right. Here. So,
I found that too. Like, it's really easy sometimes to like assume like this is how it works and this is like the slick experience, but like you end up creating something that's too clever by half instead of something that actually meets your customers' needs.
Yeah. And customers have dynamic problems, right? Like that problem is not the same when you're working with them. So, it's like, I particularly came to learn about that level of complexity, like partnering with customers as a professional services consultant, right? Like that was a space where within like one SOW, the problem would change, right? You would articulate it the same way, but the true like underbelly of that problem was dramatically different. And so the solutions you would put together or build for your customer would change like mid SOW. Like I'm hyper aware of that as I try to scale stuff, which is that like, you have to scale and offer programs that are going to still be relevant as that outcome shifts, evolves, like even within the same times, like, you know, recent time span. So I do have some design principles around building the program that I covered, that I can get into. I think one of them you mentioned in your keynote as well.
Was that experimentation?
Well, actually, there's probably a couple then. I was thinking of garbage in, garbage out, but let's go through, those.
Yes. No, let's talk. So you mentioned optionality already, right? Customers can have different paths to success. Garbage in, garbage out is a really good one. And I loved, because I wanted to mention this as well, that you talked about this, like you used a dumpster fire icon. Contact management, consent framework, data hygiene. Like this is the bugbear for so many teams doing any sort of digital programs.
Yeah.
But also like, I appreciate that you brought that up, because so many of us feel within our individual programs, like, why don't we have this right? Why don't we have perfect data? Yeah. Why do we need to do so much work to clean this up? And you just called that out. So tell me more about Tell me more about that. Garbage in, garbage
out. I've never had perfect data ever, and I don't think I ever will, and I'm comfortable with that. But what I try to do and what we try to do on our team is like have high confidence in a set of data. And then that's what we automate an action on. And so I think splicing data, you know, and then continuing to try to improve a lot of it is just like how we look at this stuff. There's a lot of manual work involved in automation. Who knew, right? And so so that's really the design principle underneath all of this is that like make sure that you're doing that. You know, I know CS teams are usually taking like a day sort of like off calls to like update their own data manually as well. Right. And so like there's like various ways that you could do this internally, but I think it's just something you're going to constantly have to work on because that's what as a digital success team, you don't have the luxury of, you know, being able to override data mistakes with your ability to talk one-on-one with a customer. Right. And like get great information and support them despite that. Right. You're getting what your team put into Salesforce. Yeah. You're getting what the customer chose to fill out on a form, which like when was the last time you filled out a form on a product that you used? You probably couldn't think of it, but even when you did, like I filled one out recently and I decided I didn't like some of the questions. So I didn't fill out that data because I have a short life. We are not all going to live for hundreds of years, right? Like let's not spend it filling out forms. So anyway, I was like, you got to work with some of this stuff. We have like third party tools, right, that we use for data validation and things like that. So I mean, like all of that is part of building this team, but don't let it trip you up. And it's not something that you're going to need like tons of resources for, but you are going to need a lot of collaboration cross-functionally. So make friends with your ops teams. Like, you know, I recommend if you're building out a digital success program that you have a solutions architect that's very, very familiar with things like Gainsight, things like Snowflake, things like Tableau, things like Salesforce, because you're that person in your ops team. That's how you're going to get this motion moving. But it's never going to be perfect. You're never going to be happy with it. So just make your peace with it. We live
for our data and systems team and have ops people who need to get like deeper and deeper into that.
Yeah, for sure. So those were the first two. It was like optionality and then contact management. The third one was digital as a foundational journey, right? So this we talked about a little bit as well, but it's like making sure that there's a baseline digital happy path journey that you create for your customers. And you know, that's sequenced with all of the content, the like touch points, you know, events and things like that, that you will build out over time, but you've got that foundational, you know, happy path customer journey. That is
and like difficult. Before we go into other principles, why don't we actually go over to that? Because you shared a great visual of the happy path and the off track path and how those all fit together.
You've got this happy path, and essentially, like the happy path is fully digital. It's that foundational journey, meaning the moment that the deal is closed or the customer purchases your product, you know, you can start onboarding them. Then you get them to adoption, you get them to renewals or what we call pre-renewals because the renewals are actually happening sort of independent of you, right? And then after that, it's about like year two, year three programs. It's about growing, it's about growth and it's about advocacy, right? Those advocacy programs, you might be working on them, you know, if you own community or if you're partnering with marketing or whatever that is. So the happy path is really those four phases. I mean, you can call them whatever you want. You can have less, more phases, whatever it is, but it's essentially onboarding through to adoption and renewal, right? That's what you're doing, the happy path. Now, naturally in that phase or in those phases, your customer is your beautifully designed journey is not going to go as planned, right? So they might veer off the path. So you might have milestones attached, let's say to onboarding where you're like if I think about Box as an example, just not to always use Miro, but like when I think about Box, it's like, okay, we're going to help them set up and implement Box. That might take, let's say, 45 days, right? So you have a 45-day implementation milestone. That's when you're going to deploy the product. And if that's not happening, then they're actually off track, right? And so they're going to go into your risk program where you're going to try to get them back on track. Like off track could be, it could be something as simple as like they did not set up SSO. And we all know that that is like table stakes for getting a license activated and adoption going, because nobody wants to mess with signing up, and you're obviously in an enterprise and it's like you know, security, et cetera. So that's a really simple example, but that's like an off track milestone that you're going to track in that journey. And then you're going to have digital programs that try to get that, let's say, admin persona who's responsible for setting SSO up, you know, to get them reminders, or maybe it's your implementation team and, you know, at your customers, and they need the reminders to like work with their IT team to get that going. Right. So that's like an example, but there's multiple milestones. This can get complex. My recommendation is like, have very clear and look at the data for this, right? Like you can do reverse engineering, look at your highly successful accounts. Again, using a very overly simplistic example of SSO, chances are 90% of your most successful accounts are using SSO or some form of authentication, right? So that is, that risk mitigation program is really, again, digital as well. If you start over time seeing that everybody goes off track and that that risk program is required pretty much all the time, you actually should probably reconsider the happy path phase. You should probably elevate your risk program into your happy path phase, right? And then you should like change your markers for risk. And so that's like how we look at it. I think your risk journey is going to be much more dynamic than your happy path, but your happy path is going to be much more plentiful and robust. And most of the programs that you develop will probably live there.
A lot of the content and proactive programs are probably focused on designing for the happy path, but you need those interventions, like you mentioned, to like pull people from, like to identify like what does risk equal and how do we pull people back onto the happy path. But I wanted to tie in, like that was one of your principles as well, like monitoring risk across the entire journey. But this also you tugged on something for a moment that maybe we can pull out a little bit more, like thinking about the other teams that are focused on human-led interventions, not just digital ones. Like even if you are calling out where risk exists, even if you're trying to like automate customers back into it, you also call that as a principle that there's a hybrid digital and field model. So how that works between the digital interventions and actually pulling in humans.
Yeah, it's a great question. And it's something that I'm like still heavily experimenting with. Like I haven't found the answer to this, but in my mind, I do have a vision for like how it could work. And I'm like endlessly plugging away at trying to actually get it to work and changing my mind.
A perfect version of this,
I know. Like I always tell people, I'm like, I think about some of the things that I was doing like 2 weeks ago and I hate it all. And then what I'm doing this week that I'm really excited about, I'm going to hate it in 2 weeks, right? It's like being a teenager when you have a diary and you're writing in your diary, you're like, dear diary, like I had a fight with Adam in school today. And then like years later, when you're like 15, you're looking at it and you're like, God, what a loser. I'm going to write about like diary today. I'm like, dear diary, like today, Adam was actually okay, but like blah, blah, blah. And then like 2 years later, you look at that and you're like, God, that's, I'm such a loser. Like that's what I'm writing about in my diary. That's terrible. So
I've really come to like, look at that as like, that means growth. If you cringe at something that you remember doing in the past, like that probably means you've grown.
I know. But it's like, it's just so, it's incredibly hard to be somebody who is both a perfectionist and also like has embraced a lot of mistake making and is very like open to being a loser and making a lot of mistakes. It's like very hard. It's like it's two sides of the same coin, but I think that's what makes for I think good people in scaled CX, right? Like you're going to be humbled every day by what actually happens and what your customers really need. And you're going to realize that like, you don't have all the answers. Your product can solve all of the problems and that everything is about that human piece first. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and I try to keep that front and center, when we talk about automating programs or when we do AI first program, and that really is like the underpinning of this hybrid model, right? It's about being able to recognize, for example, yes, you've got risk across the journey, but let's say another overly simplistic example of risk that I used in the talk was like, what if they start like exporting content like in batches from your tool? Maybe don't send a digital only program. Like maybe pull in your AE, maybe not even your CSM, like maybe pull in your AE. So that's kind of when I started to look at like realistically, how would we behave as a team? that's when this like hybrid and field model started to change, because initially it was about scaling CS. So how do we pull in our CSMs, you know, on the scale journey where they have the digital first happy path and the digital first risk path, and then that doesn't get them to where we want. So then we pull in the scaled CSM. And then I started to realize, well, there, in a lot of cases, a CSM would actually pull in an AE, or they would pull in an education team member or somebody like an SE or whatever it is. And I was like, well, this hybrid model actually needs to move beyond CS, and it needs to become CX, it needs to become sales. So then we really started working with like other tools as well. So it's like not just in Gainsight, but like you can experiment if your team is using tools like Gong or POCUS or whatever, like how you, what are these signals and how do you also then interface with your team internally when you get signals from the customer? So it's a bit of an internal and external design principle, but the idea here is that you should make sure that the customer, and again, it's not just about risk. It's like also in the happy path. If there's something happening that's like really encouraging and you're like, wow, there's a new line of business that just came on, it's legal, we should actually probably connect them to somebody, you know, maybe internally on our legal team, and like grow this relationship and build this use case within this line of business, right? So you can do it in all these ways, but the idea is like, don't get in the way of human touch, but augment human touch and make sure that you use it in more strategic ways.
Yeah. And I really love that about your program, because I mean, it reflects in some ways the practicality of not every customer, in fact, many customers just won't, right, follow this ideal digital path or respond to risk signals in a consistent way. Like, let humans do what humans do best and intervene and grasp the nuance and build relationships. And in fact, you called this out, I think, at the end as a like a gotcha. You had a lot of really good gotchas. And one of it was, if your scaled CX program is just email and some pop-ups and doesn't involve, like when I was asking you about the mix of programs, if it doesn't involve other programs, then like you probably are still operating on more of a superficial level.
Yeah. And I think like this is also where the like the fights with like PLG and marketing like begin, right? Is like people, and I think everybody has something to learn from each other here, which is that like these are all business channels and we all have to figure out how to use them, right? So like what I'm advocating for is, I'm not saying don't send emails or don't do things in apps. Like we absolutely have to, and they need to be targeted and personalized and all of that, all of those types of things. But just don't make it to where you're over focusing on like the mechanisms of becoming a lifecycle email team or like whatever, because that's not like the customers don't want that. That's not what they're looking for anyway, right? And that's not your job. That's already done somewhere else in a company. Like what they're looking for, digital success, is actually outcomes based success, right? Like, and so you might need to use these channels to like give them what they need to get there. But that's not like the channel's not the goal, right? It's just the distribution mechanism.
That's actually even why at Personio, we moved from having like a channels team who also owned customer communication and did all the mass comms and the push comms, to be like, oh, actually, no, we're kind of spamming our customers. Let's work more closely with marketing. Let's distribute responsibilities. Let's have a customer attention budget, and let's focus more on things that are trigger based or segmented or are actually going to like resonate with some sort of need or outcome that we're driving towards.
I love that. What is this customer attention budget? Tell me more.
Customer attention budget, it's gone between being a hard concept and a spiritual concept. So, you know, we at various points, we've gone from having actually a within a given week, what is our target for the number of emails a customer should receive from Personio? And how can we monitor that? And how can we do outlier detection? So we've gotten as precise as that, not on a customer by customer basis, but on average, because we do want to do some level of throttling, but like it's not, it like throttling and suppression can become really complex if you don't think through every single permutation of that. But before that, it even started as more of, let's say, a vibes based concept, where it's like even thinking about how can we, in general, coordinate and push back between any individual area of the business that wants to use the same channel to communicate with customers, to understand where we should and shouldn't interact with them. And you know, we run a customer relationship survey where we get a gauge from customers on what types of communications they are more or less enthusiastic to receive. Mm-hmm. And that also helps us say, hey, you know what? We can run more informational emails to them on product updates. But what annoys them is unsolicited upsell comms. So there we're going to be more more targeted and you know, on average, run fewer of those.
Yeah. I love that. That's the way to do it, right? It's like making sure that there's a little bit more centralization of this, regardless of company size, because if you've got functions, if you've got departments, everyone's going to want to email, right? Like, that's the reality.
Totally.
And it, again, a business channel. And then I think having the governance and the touch governance on top of that, not over complicating it, but I think caring about it enough to make it as complicated as it needs to be so that your customer doesn't suffer. Like that, yeah. like don't, you know, that's the thing I always get really annoyed about. It's like, all of these things sound overly corporate and overly like, but they're not. And
like, don't spam your customer is a very human thing.
Don't spam your customer like means that you're going to need to like get a little bit buttoned up. And that's actually a good thing, right? Like, I think startups and corporate can all learn from each other. And it's a miss. This is my other soapbox. It's like, it's a myth that startups are fast and corporates are slow. I've worked at a startup that was considered like the most fast paced in the world, and I thought it was slow. You know, I worked at Visa, which like has this reputation for being like a slow financial. No, it was really rapid and fast. And we were like a startup within, you know, a larger company. Yeah. So it's like, none of these things makes like, just do right by the customer and try not to have any like sacred cows, right?
Yeah. And I think like whether you're looking at this comms piece that you're talking about right now, or the contact management and data piece that you're talking about earlier, like accepting that these are not completely solved problems and they're always going to be inherently right. messy. Like mm-hmm. try to make it a little bit better. Don't try to like shortcut to perfect because you're not going to get there.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
maybe that speaks a little bit to why you have experimentation as a principle. But the one I really want to ask you about is, because you had a strong opinion about this, and I think maybe maybe a heterodox one was this whole piece about in-house production and experience design.
Yeah,
because you have a whole part of your team that's focused on production and AI,
mm-hmm.
and AI might even be its whole other episode. We've talked about AI; we should talk about AI again. But like,
we'll keep talking about it. Yeah,
you were on your soapbox about teams should have in-house production and not outsource it. Like, say more about that.
Yeah. And I think, and I'll just say again, I mean, CX teams, right? That's what I mean. So if like it's a marketing team, like I don't, you can get an agency, you can get, you know, folks to outsource like ads or, you know, like content for landing page and that kind of thing. I'm talking about deeper how-to content, educational content, success-based content, that kind of thing. I think you should do in-house. Why do I think this? I've developed this bias over years of working in content, right? So I worked in journalism. I worked in media for years, right? With way higher stakes than thankfully what you and I have to deal with now is like, yeah, I worked in the news, breaking stories, that kind of thing. And so you realize pretty quickly that building a capacity within your team, within your own house, that's actually the unlocker for speed and innovation. Right? Because you're together every day, you're deeply involved in the needs of the business, you're working, you're talking to your customers in a way that CSMs are talking to their customers every day. So if you're trying to scale CX, like you really should be as close to your customers as possible. And when you outsource these things, even if you're outsourcing parts of it that you feel like you're directing, things get lost in handoffs. We all know that. Things, you know, it's a game of telephone. And ultimately, it doesn't actually save you as much money, and it doesn't actually make you more innovative and faster over time. And I've learned that in many contexts, right? News, different industries that I've verticals that I've worked in, right? From fintech to HR tech to, you know, SaaS collaboration software. Like in every single case, in-house investment in a small team is going to save you more money, and is going to result in faster innovation, particularly right now with things like AI that you want your like video producers and content production teams to become super familiar with. Like you need to make sure that, you know, you have complete, honestly, like ownership of their time and priorities to invest in those things. Now, are there cases where we would outsource? Absolutely. Like, again, it depends on the content that you're building, but your core team should be in-house. You should not have a core team.
I'm glad you mentioned AI as well. Because, and by the way, I believe in this too. Like, I'm a big have an in-house team person, yeah. And I think it's paid dividends. We have an amazing video team at Personio that I deeply respect the work they do, and they're focused not just on producing like the high quality multimedia assets between video. We have a designer as well. But also focusing on how we scale those same standards and tooling to other teams who work with them.
Right.
And so I was glad to hear you talk about AI as well, because like you could argue AI both ways. You could say like AI is a form of outsourcing and we must continue to handcraft everything, you know, have like a, like an Italian tailor come in and like chisel every video. Or you could say like, no, actually AI is a great complement to an in-house team, because an in-house team using AI becomes more effective at what they do. It sounds like you're saying the latter.
Yeah. And actually, like I think of AI as outsourcing more than I think of it as like outsourcing your internal team. Right. And I think like a lot of support teams, for example, think this way too. But it's, yeah. Absolutely 100%. Like we've got three amazing multimedia folks on our team that are building out all sorts of assets and that are also responsible for things like unique illustrations, 3D animation, and like avatar creation and adaptation, right? Like they're continuing to iterate on that avatar and giving us the ability to do realistic, non-Uncanny Valley type of AI courses and customized videos and QBRs and things like that to our customers. So it's like, you want to have that internally. You want that person to work closely with your CSMs and then get that stuff to customers, get the response, feedback, reaction, then iterate really quickly. So that's a big principle. You mentioned experimentation. Obviously, like that's a big, it's like PLG bread and butter for us. That was another principle. And then to wrap it kind of up, like I think we already talked about risk across the entire journey. And also like I've said this before, it's like resist false dichotomies, right? Like,
I was really interested in that one.
Yeah, I have a bunch of them and I have a list somewhere. Like, what are the false dichotomies? I always talk about like, you don't have to pick PLG or SLG. Like you can do both and any smart company should and any smart CX team should. What are some other ones? It's like digital is a segment and a strategy. It doesn't have to be one or the other, right? I have a bunch of them, but that's the other thing is like, I'm trying not to put us in a box and I'm you know, this is an evolving field and we should be, we're trying to influence it, but it's also influencing us. So.
Yeah, or like I don't you don't need to choose like focusing on happy path or risk, like you can do both.
Right. 100%.
Like, in fact, you need to do both. Yeah. So like I like how you kind of tied all that up in the end. You sort of had an order of operations where it's like, okay, you can start with the email journeys and in-app flows, but like then your evolution was into that completely digital segment. And I love that you called out as well like what owning the segment meant, like variable comp.
I used to be afraid of it.
Well, it's scary because you're accountable for something.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is too, we forget you're still getting paid all the other percentage to do your job and be a little bit fuzzier, but you got to hit those numbers. And that's how you would get additional investment as well, right? It's like now you've got tied into revenue. You're tied in, you know, you've got skin in the game. You know, I worked for a seasoned executive who used to joke that like, we want to build like highly accountable teams. And so, you know, and I remember someone being like, well, when you think about accountable, is it like metrics? Like, what is it? And it's like, it's all of it. It's like, you are the wringable neck if this doesn't work or if something goes wrong, right? The idea here is like, essentially variable comp is something that CSMs have. They're responsible for their book of business. If, you know, like their fates are tied to their customers. And I think that's a beautiful model, actually. It also allows you to like get out of infighting internally and be like, this customer needs this to succeed.
Yeah.
The conversation needs to be here in this room. There's no escalations. We're going to do what it takes to like excel to help the customer excel. And I love that. And I think it democratizes internal hierarchies. I think it does a lot of good for teams. But I think that there are some things you have to be careful about as well, right? I think this is the reason why people are fighting over email. It's because everyone is responsible for a metric. And sometimes we the behavior changes so far that like you forget about that other, you know, if you're on a 80-20 split, let's say, you forget about the other 80% because you're trying to optimize for the 20. So you have to be really careful as a leader as you like put these things together. But But variable comp is awesome. Embrace it. And I think the idea here is that, like, when you own a segment, you are responsible for every single customer there, activating your product, adopting your product, and then at least having a flat renewal. You know, we say that these days in this tough economy, but like the idea is you want to expand if you can. Now, mm-hmm. that's not going to be a huge number in a digital segment, right? Because those are usually smaller employee size companies that are coming in and buying a handful of licenses. But also in PLG companies, you're going to get people under whatever your digital success threshold is coming in and trying your product out. Almost PLG mm-hmm. makes POCs, you know, like that's what it is. It's like PLG
that's,
is not
that's
like,
POC proof of concept, proof of not concept. POC point of contact.
Yes. Yeah, okay. Thank you always for calling me out on my acronyms. But like, yeah, sales led growth, the older ways of working with customers, we're kind of doing PLG already with the you know, go to market SLG model involving them trying your product for mm-hmm. a month, but also having all of the people supporting them in implementation, blah, 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 blah. Sometimes you charge like a nominal fee for it, whatever it is. But the idea here is like, you're responsible for that entire, like the success, like your product powering their success essentially.
Yeah. And this is why like this whole idea of like owning the segment really resonated with me. You know, I was asking you about this upfront because you're right. It's not a panacea. It doesn't mean that everything goes completely, like it doesn't resolve all conflicts, but it does give you a lot more ownership. And I think sometimes in customer education or community or digital or programs like that, we don't fully grok like what does ownership mean? Like who can make a decision about something without escalation? And this does give you more of that, even if there are still going to be some conflicts in a PLG company, like with the product experience, in an SLG motion with the sales team,
right,
et cetera. Like it's going to happen, but you have more latitude to make decisions.
And even if you don't, because like, again, it's like, I think it just depends on company structure, right? Sometimes a lot of the like decision making can be structurally just hoarded at the top where it's like maybe Adam and Dee are ultimately making the decision and not the CSM or the program manager in digital CS. And like, that's a problem for a separate episode. But I think even if you don't have a ton of autonomy to make decisions when you own a segment, what you do have is the ability to be the voice of that segment. You're going to notice things because that's the book that you're covering as like a digital success program manager, as an example, that other people in other segments don't have those same problems or their personas are different. Like, for example, for us, you know, one of our digital success program managers, Allie, is like deeply concerned with the experience of our admins. Like that's what she thinks about every day. You need somebody whose job it is to think about these critical personas every single day. And they are a very different, like, and she's responsible both for the segment and then the like up segment admins as well. And like admins in our specific segment and in the scaled segment are so different from admins in the strat mm-hmm. segment, right? It makes perfect sense because in smaller companies, you're going to be voluntold to be an admin, right? Of a tool. Yep. You might be a product manager. You might be like, my sister's an admin for Miro or was like, and she's a product designer, right? But like at a smaller company. Now somebody at Salesforce is going to bring in 4 admins from IT to administer all tools, right? And so that admin is like a career admin and technical persona is very different from somebody who's voluntold to be an admin. So the journey and the way you approach them and the offerings and things like that are going to be very different. And that's Ali's job, is to care about admins regardless of where they are, but understand the needs of the segment, be able to think about, okay, are we actually segmenting the right way when it comes to this persona? What is their cohort? Like, what does their patch actually look like? And how should we serve them? And are we covering their needs across their journey? So that's, I think, the important part about it, right? It's like the ownership maybe doesn't equate to decision-making autonomy internally, although it really, really should. And people should be building healthy organizations, not hoarding, you know, decision-making at the top. You got to get it through the system. It's like about the, like owning the experience of the customer and being accountable for it, right? So that like when the customer is unhappy, you and your inner ally feel it.
Yeah. And I think that kind of gets us to then the, you know, kind of the last points that you were making, because you were talking, again, we talked about this earlier, the digital human interactions, which on one hand is having that digital base plus pulling in humans, using those signals, using those calls to action or CTAs. But also, and I love that you made this point, that the other part of like digital and human is not leaving customer research to your UX team and actually having your team deeply involved in UX, which I think is sort of what you were just talking about, but I'm not sure if there's anything else that you want to say about that.
Yeah, no, it's it is and it isn't also. Like, so that this is actually something that like this is the product manager, the ex-product manager in me, right? It's like, how are you not talking to your customers on a regular basis? Like in my old product teams I used to have, like when I was in ed tech, I was like, you got to talk to 3 customers a week. That was the, like, everybody does that. That's like a thing in product from like 10 years ago. And so that's like that's the thing that I want all digital success program managers to do, is like talk to your customers all the time. Like, yes, you're not really talking to them about the journey or the account or whatever, but you're doing user research with customers in your segment and across all segments so that you can build better programs, right? So you're not a CSM. Like, I want to make that really clear. It's not about talking to your customers in that CSM-y way. It's actually learning about UX research and then conducting that, right? And so there's a couple ways you can do that. Early in my career, I read a book by Erica Hall and A Book Apart and like just figured out how to badly do it myself. So I did that for many years. I was fortunate then to work at like a product design agency where I learned quite a lot about UX research. I then got to work in Visa's like fully like decked out UX research lab where you could literally like sit behind a two-way mirror, watch how people interact with your product. It's fascinating, right? To then being able to actually get trained by, like at Miro, we just had our head of UX research come in and like train our team. They have these programs and they train different functions on how to do your own UX research. And that's super useful. So this is kind of like a side quest that I really have loved in my career, is like understanding user experience research and like really trying to bring it into my, you know, CX teams that I've led over the years, and doing it as an IC. So that's just like a me thing. I don't know that people would consider that required. You can use research from your existing user teams, and you certainly don't need this capability right off the bat, but I think it's
important. But I think it shows in like the quality and empathy and polish of your programs too. So
thank you.
I think those who choose to pick up that mantle it'll pay off.
It really does. And, you know, again, with all of the types of content that are being generated right now, I think this is a distinguishing factor. You're going to be able to speak to people in a way that's going to cut through channel noise, through, you know, some of the Gen AI, not great stuff that's out there. And I think
AI slop.
Right. And like AI slop. Yeah. The inshittification. Right. Like, and I think we're going to get to a place where that's really going to come through, and we're already seeing it. We're already seeing like a lot of trends in the industry of what content is being consumed longer and what people are coming back to. Right. So,
yeah. Okay. So then like last point, because you had one more gotcha in there that I thought was, we have a lot of people listening to us from the CS world and they're like CSM leaders and they're like, I'm going to build a digital or scaled program, but really it's just like a CSM assist program. Mm-hmm. And you called that out actually as a gotcha. So what's the gotcha there, Dee? Like, why shouldn't we do that?
So this was actually something when I was first starting out this team and I was like talking to other leaders in digital CX and CS at the, you know, understanding like how they were building and what they were learning. Like that was a piece of advice that was given to me by several folks. Like I'll just shout out a few, like Allison, who I think you worked with at Slack.
Allison Barrett.
Well, that's the other Allison I was going to mention. I was talking
Allison
about
McPhail.
Allison
McPhail. There are two dear Allisons. They're
yes,
both awesome.
Two amazing.
Yes, shout out to both
incredible Allisons. Yes. Like they both had given me that advice. And then, our other mutual friend over at, I don't think she's there anymore, but is it Ironclad that she was on?
Caitlin Wood.
Caitlin Wood was another one who had like mentioned this. There were like several people that I had talked to that were basically just like, don't let this become a backwater where it's really just like you're kind of doing things separately from the CS like main engine. But then also like when you are in the main engine, like don't become just like CSM assist or like you're just sending emails on behalf of CSMs or you're helping with Gainsight or whatever that is, right? Like you're going to understand their day-to-day. You're going to be able to then like help from a strategic perspective, like automate a bunch of the work that they do, give them automated programs that they can then customize the experience themselves for their book of business, but then make sure that you are really focused on those business metrics, right? Like saving time and optimizing is good. But when you over-focus on that, it becomes this weird crutch and it like creates a kind of inertia that's actually not productive at all. Ultimately, you really want to be optimizing for those customer and business-centric metrics, right?
Even if it's something, for instance, like customer contact rate, which is still a customer experience
right.
related metric that drives efficiency. But I agree. Like, it's, I think
yeah.
if we're only looking at that, then we're limiting what our programs can drive as well.
Yeah. And I think it's like, it's so important when you're, you know, when you're doing this kind of work that you have a really strong grasp of scoping, prioritizing, and weighing the sort of like impact of programs, because you're going to get so many requests and you're going to need to look at your, like what's coming off of your backlog, into being work in progress, limit work in progress, and pick the things that are going to have the highest impact. Right now, sometimes mm-hmm. you're going to have to break that rule and say, we're going to do these low impact things so we don't make technical debt a thing that happens, right? Like back to kind of what you and I were talking about before, like spending time, like building it right and all of that. But for the most mm-hmm. part, you want to have a really healthy portfolio of things that's like 80% is customer facing and 20% of it is like, you know, and yep. again, we all use 80-20. It's probably closer to 70-30, but like that should be your guide, right? And then
vibes, 80-20 vibes.
Vibes, 80-20 vibes, yes.
Pareto vibes. Pareto vibes yeah. around these parts. Exactly. In this house, we respect Pareto vibes.
That's right.
Dee, you have re-energized me about everything that energized me the first time about your talk, with the added bonus of this time I'm not hungover. So like that's
even better. You go. That's my gift to you, my friend. I'll just say, like, in the slides, I have started building this out. It is a work in progress, but I did start building out like a beginner's guide to AI and scaled CX. So like past the hype, what are the like tools or problems that you can solve and support customer education, digital scaled CS, and then like across all of it, that is in the deck. So that will be available for folks. You can use what's in there right now. Adam and I will flesh this out. And I think over time, as we start to invite guests to this podcast as well, we'll kind of get their take on it. And I think this can become a nice like crowdsource, like we all co-own this and it can serve as an artifact for CX practitioners who are getting started in their AI journeys.
Dee, this was awesome. And what do we say? How do we want to wrap this up?
So I'd love for people to engage with us again on our LinkedIn. I'd love to hear what core programs you're running, and whether it's scaled CX, whether it's digital CX or digital CS, or if you're incorporating scale in professional services, wherever in CX, let us know. There is in my deck like a slide of potential team streams and programs, a bunch of stickies of like what I've heard, what we're running, you know, and what you run too, Adam. But if there's anything that's not specifically on that slide, and that's slide 5, let us know. Like, let's build scaled CX together, and let's continue to evolve.
I love it. And so join us on our LinkedIn page, where we'll post that prompt as well. We can get into discussion together. Dee and I post on our personal LinkedIns. Be online friends with us. Be real life friends with us. Be music friends with Alan Coda, who does our music. He's at Acoda. It's been a pleasure as always, Dee, and listeners. We'll see you around the way.
See ya.
Maybe we already bantered a lot. We banted.
Bantered a lot, so we just do the intro and we like get right into it.
Do you feel banted? My
entire life is banter, so I need to be told like we're done with the banter. Let's skip. And then
that's why we have a podcast together, because we like the bants.
It's for the bants.
We do it for the bants. Got to do it
love
for the bants.
The bants.
What